Well, I think fans of superhero TV shows have a lot to be thankful for, especially viewers of DC shows like Supergirl, now that's on CW, and so on and so forth. And since it's Thanksgiving time now...
Is it?
I changed the clocks, so it is for right now.
Okay.
No, I mean, usually we talk about, around Thanksgiving time on the show, what we're thankful for, and we didn't do that this year because we were focused on other stuff, specifically fielding these interviews that we have in our long-running hashtag Women's Rights,
right.
WRITES segment, of which we have a great interview today as well. But I was thinking before we get started, we could maybe trade some of our things that we're thankful for.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I can go first to get us going.
Why don't you, Cal?
I'm thankful for whatever is in the water in Midtown Manhattan right now that is causing the people at Marvel Corporate, that
yes.
is the comic book division,
mm-hmm.
to fill their books these days, make a point of filling the ranks of heroes with diversity, sexual diversity, racial diversity, orientation diversity,
yes.
LGBTQ, and on down the line. And it doesn't look like it's going to dry up anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got old character, legacy characters that are changing from their original, you know, sort of white male roots. You have brand new characters. You've got new books announced every day. You've got switch ups and teams and people reconfiguring and new people coming on. And there doesn't seem, there's no slowdown
right.
at all. And it doesn't look like there's, even in our current climate, I think it's only going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think we've gone past a wall that we can't ever go back, which is great,
yes.
which is where we want to be. And I think that one of the reasons that that is happening right now is the water, but it's also comics' roots in pulp and its correlation or its common ancestor with science fiction and fantasy writing. I think because both mediums want to, they're designed to push the bar forward, or
sure.
at least to speculate beyond and give us a speculative sort of view of a world that we don't have,
right.
but perhaps we want to have. But not Terminator. That sounds
no,
horrible. I don't want that at all.
No, that's too far.
And so, you know, kudos to, I mentioned comics, but I'll tag SFF on there too, because I know that there's a lot of those titles are doing the same thing. So it looks great.
Yeah, it does.
It looks a lot more like our world, because I think when people more versed in things like this than me have said this, but when you open a book and you can read about a character that's like you, it's so much more engrossing for you as a reader and just as an appreciator of what you're checking out.
Mm-hmm. Something that I'm thankful for, and this kind of relates to our interview later today, but is just Doctor Who fandom in general. And, you know, just the ability for Who to bring fans together and squee, and also in delightful squabbles. You know, over like who is the best doctor or
Squee
who
and
is
Squabbles, trademark it, new podcast.
Ooh, I love it.
Well, we've got
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
That's ours. You can't have that.
I mean, that's just one
Squabbles
thing.
And Squee.
Ooh.
We came back. We came
yes.
back. We looped back. We,
yes.
It's better now.
Second time. There's something about that fandom. And it, I mean, other fandoms have similar things, but there's something about it that is just overwhelmingly positive. And I think maybe it's just it's so much fun.
Fandom of the Opera. We'll take that one, too. It's a music, a theater-based focus. Operas about, you take a space opera, and then you're going to sing it on stage. I see, like, a sci-fi show, maybe,
sure.
or, like, Bravo.
Yeah.
Yeah. 13 episodes. I'm thankful for all these ideas we're having. Get our pitches ready. We don't have to do, like, three apiece, but I'm going to grab onto yours, I think. I'm going to hitch my wagon to that star. Yeah, I agree about the diversity in sci-fi, especially on television as well. I was watching an episode of the show Dark Matter the other day, and it opens up, and we have this crew of, you know, several different, five, six, seven individuals or whatever, and we're following three of these individuals. They're all talking, and it is two women and one man,
mm-hmm.
and none of them are white, or at least not exclusively white.
Yep.
They're all something else.
Mm-hmm.
And, I guess if I just didn't, the fact that I'm mentioning it, it's kind of like, doesn't count anymore. You know what I mean?
No, I think it counts. It
well,
absolutely
no,
counts.
No, I mean, if like, I guess I'm realizing now, but like if I watched it and the whole thing, I was like, can you believe this? This is so amazing. I want us to get to the point where like,
it's not amazing
a couple
anymore.
Days later, I go, Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's like the time I was playing XCOM. XCOM's this game where you fight aliens and you put like a team together, and the team's made up of like people from all nations and colors and sexes and races and stuff. And you just put the best team together. We had to go out and kill the aliens. And I put all the put the team together. Yeah, get the gun there. These guys got the grenades ready to go. And you hit go, and they all go, "Let's go," in their lady voices. And I was like, oh, I put an entire lady team together. I wasn't even paying attention to that.
Way to go, me.
Yeah. And unlock achievement for white male privilege. Do you have anything else?
Yeah. You know what else I'm thankful for? I'm thankful for Star Wars and for it continuing to, even if I have some trepidations about Rogue One, I'm still really excited about the film. And I love how enthusiastic Star Wars fans continue to be. Maybe my whole thing is just fan enthusiasm.
I think it probably is.
But
it's a good theme for this show today, too.
Yeah, I just, you know, it's refreshing.
I would say, selfishly, the last thing I would want to say is I'm thankful for Team Ico for finally finishing The Last Guardian, which will be out in a couple weeks.
Very cool.
Or actually in like 10 days or so. It's the Team Ico created the game Ico, or Ico, and Shadow of the Colossus, mm-hmm. two classic games, award-winning, transformed people's experiences, go way beyond what you think of as a game, and The Last Guardian is supposed to do that as well, and is getting kind of mixed reviews. But I don't care. It's the end of an era. Jedi sucked too, compared to Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, so still going to get it and play it. Well, this is a podcast that you're listening to. It is the Just Enough Trope podcast. I'm your host, Caliban, joined as always by my co-host.
Hi, I'm Ikan Hanna.
And we are here on a special day that is not Thanksgiving. My producer is telling me right now, not Thanksgiving, past Thanksgiving, a couple weeks past, but we're still excited about the day anyway. We got an exciting show today. We are talking to Lynn M. Thomas. Mm-hmm. She's a curator of rare books, the head of special collections, and an associate professor at Northern Illinois University. We had a lovely talk with her at Convergence of this year, the Convergence Convention in the Twin Cities. And we did an interview with her recently, which will be on the show today. She's authored a couple different books like...
Yes, Chicks Dig Time Lords.
Yes, and other books in the Geek Girls Chronicles. She's also the editor-in-chief of Uncanny Magazine, which mm-hmm. is a sci-fi magazine. So we'll get to all that in a little bit when we talk to Lynn M. Thomas. Also, it's Friday, which means Comic Book Club, which in this case means batten down the hatches, get ready to have your face kicked. It's next wave, The Agents of Hate.
Oh, yes.
We're doing all 12 issues. I was going to say the first two volumes, the only two volumes, entitled, not in front of me right now, I'm going to guess, This Is What They Want is the first one. And I think the second one is literally, I Kick You in the Face or something like that. And so anyway, we'll know more about that when we talk about that later. Warren Ellis and Stuart Immonen. Drop Koalas Incoming.
Yeah,
this one.
I mean, just a fun book.
Yeah.
Looking forward to talking about it.
So we'll do that. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Cal. Just full swing winter. I don't know about you, but it feels...
Is that by the Brian Setzer Orchestra?
It sounds like it, doesn't it? It just sounds like fun. It sounds like sleigh bells and like, you know, carolers. No, I just feel like there are so many people who are sick right now. And it's like... I feel like I'm going to get sick whenever I hear somebody coughing.
Yeah, you know.
And I don't know.
Captain
like,
Trips.
Yeah. I mean, and just like, I just feel like I'm shivering constantly. Like I'm drinking cups of coffee just to keep my hands warm at work.
That might be why you're shivering.
Yeah.
What came first, the chicken or the over-caffeinated egg?
I know, right? I'm probably just like caffeinating myself like way too much, but.
Well, I got sick already, so I'm good.
Oh, okay. Got it out
of
the
way. I mean, I hope you're okay, but. No, I had that thing where you kind of get a little bit. Well, this is how I get sick. I'm like, where'd that come from?
Mm-hmm.
And then I go about my business. The next day, it's like, just throat's a little.
Got a little tickle.
A little sticky.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, it's like, oh, boy, I don't know. My head doesn't feel great. And then 3 days of Ebola. And then, you know, IV fluids and
right.
Rehabilitation. And then I'm kind of back. And it sort of takes its time. I almost wish that I would just get it all. Like the 24-hour thing. But my body's like, oh, no, be frugal. Breaks it up. We can make this into a 78-hour flu.
Yeah.
We can stretch this forever.
I know. I feel like my body likes to, like, pair it out in like symptoms too. Like it's either I either get a runny nose or a sore throat,
okay, right,
and then followed by a sore throat or a runny nose.
This
you know,
like, yeah.
And it's like, why can't I just have it all at once and then just be done with it?
You're like, what is it, Mon-El or Power Lad or whatever on the Legion? He had all the powers of Superman, but he could only use them like one at a time.
Yes, exactly.
So he could fly, but he'd lose his super strength. Then he could be super strong, but he couldn't have X-ray vision.
That is so
and
incredibly
so you
complicated.
Can, like crap yourself, but you won't throw up.
Exactly.
But then you'll, you know, that'll clear up and then you'll start projectile vomiting.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They probably had a Legionnaire like that, now that I think about it. Almost definitely. Contagion Girl or something like that.
Oh, that sounds awful.
Needs fluids.
Yeah. I took a science class, a non-science science class in
First
college.
Of all, congrats.
Thank you. Called Contagious Diseases. Yep.
They just show you pictures?
No, like you learn about it and stuff like that. And I had, okay.
We watched Outbreak 27
right?
times.
It was a full semester class.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. Age difference. We watched Steven Soderbergh's Contagion.
Yes. Yes. But no, I was a theater major, surprise. And there were other theater majors and minors
off.
In my class.
Yeah.
And there was this one guy who... he had taken like makeup and everything, and he came to class one day and he had a presentation, and we're like, what happened to your head? And he had done makeup to make it look like he had anthrax.
Where is this kid?
I know, right?
He's the third leg of the stool. We need him on this thing.
It was like one of those things like, what? Who thinks that's a good idea? And then just goes ahead and does it.
That sounds like a great idea. Yeah. Up until the point that it's the boy who rouged wolf, like at some point, like you've put on too much makeup.
Yes.
Then you go to the hospital and they're like, all right, Randy, go home.
Right.
That's very good. That sounds like a lung collapse, Randy. You're getting very good at this.
Yes, exactly.
Bong, cut to the graveyard. Randy was a gifted individual. Yeah. Well, take care of yourself and take care of yourself, listeners, so you don't have to deal with that sort of thing. But I would like to see that superhero that's... maybe like you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield, it makes a mascot or something like that.
Oh,
and it's
that's
the
a terrible
sort of,
idea.
Well, you know,
but like in Japan, like everybody has.
But why
a mascot?
Does foot fungus cream have their mascot is the fungus? Why isn't it like a dude in like a white cape who's going to come in and make your nails white again?
Right, and why is Mucinex's like? Like mascot, the mucus guy. Is,
oh no, I thought okay. I was thinking of Nasonex.
Oh
no, that's
no.
The one that's. It's probably not
Antonio Banderas.
Antonio Banderas,
but it's
actually,
the guy who sounds
might,
like him.
He might do a Nasonex commercial
maybe,
at this point.
Maybe, but I almost feel like it's a guy who sounds like him, like the guy who did Garfield, whose voice is escaping his
Lorenzo
name.
Music.
Yes, thank you, Lorenzo Music, who sounds like Bill Murray, but is not Bill
right.
Murray.
But the mind twist there is that. He originally did Garfield, and then they got Bill Murray to do him for the feature film.
It's so crazy.
Whereas on The Real Ghostbusters, Lorenzo Music was the replacement for the cinematic Bill Murray. Here's the real mind screw. Apparently, Bill Murray took the job because the last name of the director on the Garfield movie was Cohen, and he thought it was the Cohen brothers. Enough of that. We got to get to this interview with Lynn M. Thomas, who we were very excited to talk to. Some of the things that we're going to talk about during the interview, and I guess, I mean, you're just going to hear them anyway, but just to sort of set you up, we talked a lot about conventions,
mm-hmm.
old things, special things, barf bags. Don't spoil it. Don't give it away. So we'll get right to it. Our interview with Lynn M. Thomas. Lynn M. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Hello. It is lovely to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. We were talking to you at Convergence this year, which is a fan-run con in Bloomington, Minnesota, like the Twin Cities. And you'd been going there for a long time before that. How many years have you been attending Convergence?
Oh, goodness. I think our first Convergence was back in 2007 or 2008. So we're close to a decade.
Wow.
And I was lucky. I was honored to be a guest of honor back in 2011.
You attend a lot of cons now, don't you?
Yes. Yes.
Can you
both as a function of my day job and as a function of being the co-editor-in-chief and co-publisher of Uncanny Magazine. My husband and I, we run that together. And We end up between the two of us, because there are some conventions that we attend separately where only one of us will go. But between the two of us, we attend between 8 and 12 a year, okay, sometimes a little more.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, so, you know, roughly one a month. I had a lot of work travel lately, so I'm really enjoying being in my own bed for the first time in a while.
Sure, yeah. Do you attend them mostly in a professional capacity, or are there any that you go to just for fun?
The one that we go to for fun fairly routinely is Chicago TARDIS, which is the Doctor Who convention that is held in Lombard, Illinois on Thanksgiving weekend every year.
Sure, okay.
So that particular convention, I mean, I'm still sort of visible as a member of the Verity podcast, but mostly it's hanging out and not being particularly scheduled. And like, if people come and like want to say hi, they can, but it's not, I'm not on, you know, I'm a civilian.
So when we talked to you last at Convergence, you talked about your background and how you got into what it is that you do, your day job. Can you tell us about that again?
Way back when dinosaurs roamed the earth and I was in college, and I probably made that same joke. I worked as a student worker in the rare book room of the library at my college. I'm a Smith College grad, so one of the Seven Sisters. Woo!
Sure.
So I was a work study student, and I landed my sophomore year a job in the rare books department of the library there. And I spent basically most of my sophomore year vacuuming books with a vacuum cleaner that strapped onto my back like a Ghostbuster.
Okay, sure.
very, very glamorous work.
Yes.
After that, I did an exchange program in France for my junior year, and then I went back to the same job senior year. And senior year, I applied to graduate school to try to do a PhD in comparative literature, and many fine programs pointed and said, ha 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 ha, no. And so I was flailing about and trying to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. And my boss at the time, who's now on the faculty at Simmons College in the library school, said, why don't you go to library school? And I thought, huh, I guess that's the thing I could do.
Sure.
But I landed a job in a library right out of college called the Library Company of Philadelphia. It's a small independent research library that Ben Franklin established in the 1730s.
Oh,
so
wow.
I worked there as a paraprofessional, which translates to I did a lot of photocopying.
Right.
After a year there of being woefully underpaid for my recently graduated genius, I decided to go to library school and ended up at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. So that's when I got my professional librarian degree, which is the entry-level degree that you need to be a professional librarian. It's kind of like being a lawyer where you need a law degree. Same
right.
thing, fewer exams.
Right.
So I got the professional degree, and then my first job out of there was as a cataloger at Yale, and I was there for about 4.5 years, and then I landed the job at Northern Illinois. Mm-hmm. I was not a science fiction person per se until I got the job at Illinois that required me to learn to be a science fiction person.
Sure.
I didn't grow up reading genre, so I'm like 20 years behind everybody else.
Sure, yeah.
Because, you know, everybody else had a head start, and I only started reading like 10 years ago. So
sure.
My to-be-read pile is abominably epic.
Never ending, sure.
I will never run out of things to read.
Well, there's a good side to that, for sure. And how did that lead into you becoming a professional nerd of sorts?
Well, it was kind of in the job description. The collection that I'm in charge of is one that focuses on popular culture in a lot of different formats. Mm-hmm. So it's children's literature and dime novels, which are kind of like the 19th century version of a Michael Bay film.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
They're novels in pamphlet form, and they are all about the explosions and very flat characters. So, like, you know, it's a good analog.
Right.
And we also had these collections of science fiction books and science fiction magazines and, you know, a bunch of other dead white guy stuff and things like that. And, you know, we have a teaching collection that we use to instruct undergraduates to learn how books are made and things like that. But when you go into a collection like this as a curator, one of the things you sit down and think about is, you know, what can I build? Where should I put my resources? What do I want to focus on? And the science fiction collection seemed like a really good candidate for that. Because building a collection like that would be a lot less expensive than deciding I was going to keep building on the Lord Byron collection, or the William Blake collection, both of which are lovely and small and really expensive at this point.
Right, yes.
I literally wouldn't have the budget to do anything really good with it. And Michael had pointed out to me when I was sort of, you know, in my first 6 months on the job going, oh, I got to think about this. He had been in fandom. I married into nerddom, basically.
Sure, right,
and
yeah.
So in the process of my slow conversion, I landed this job where suddenly I had to learn all these things about science fiction literature that I didn't know a lot about.
Sure.
So he set me a reading list to get me going. And, you know, so I could drop the appropriate names in the interview and things like that.
Right.
Total crash course. We also work on graphic novels. I'm a graduate of the girlfriend list.
Okay.
But I have gone on to read other things.
Sure.
And so the science fiction collection basically was one where that seemed like it had potential for growth, particularly because these things called conventions exist where you can actually go and talk to the authors.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And that meant that getting archives was a possibility because I'm an extrovert and I'm not afraid to talk to people. I just started going to the first couple of regional conventions. There was one in Chicago and there's one in Madison area. They were totally experiments, but they worked. After I went to those two conventions, archives started coming in. And at that point, that meant that I had been justified in explaining to my boss why they needed to fund the $300 to send me to Madison or whatever.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because I got more than that much money's worth of archives back. So
yeah.
So then, then we set a budget and started working. And so I have been haunting the corridor from Chicago to Madison to the Twin Cities ever since.
Right, yeah. It's sort of like shopping for material for the archives.
Yeah, kind of, except that I make Google Eyes at people and they give it to me instead. So it's
right,
like the best discount ever.
Right. Well, I'm interested in the decision-making process of what goes into the archive, whether it's going to be this or that, a Tom Swift novel or whatever. How you make the decision of what's worthy for the archive?
Well, it's a long and convoluted process that often involves me going, cool! It depends on the materials. In terms of science fiction, often it begins with me reading something and really liking that person's work and then Googling them to see if their archives live anywhere. I mean,
okay,
sometimes
sure.
It's just that simple. With the initial authors, it was, I started with looking at who was coming to conventions and who was going to be a guest at the convention and sort of setting up ahead of time, hey, can I take you to lunch and talk to you about your archives?
Mm-hmm.
And I would often, try to read some stories or a novel by the person in question. And then what happens is that when you get one or two people who have a good enough experience with you that they trust you, they introduce you to all of their friends.
Sure.
And by introduce you, I mean in some cases physically grab onto you and drag you over to them at conventions.
Sure.
And it kind of snowballs from there. And then you become known as Archivist Lynn and people are coming up to you.
Right.
So we're now officially sort of victims of our own success. Mm-hmm. I had to actually post on my personal blog this week, I'm not allowed to take in any more archives.
Oh, I see.
We are literally out of space.
Okay, okay.
Oh, wow.
So I can accept materials from people with whom I'm already working, but anyone who hasn't gotten stuff in is fair game for my colleagues who are doing similar things at different institutions
now. I see. And when you're talking about archives, as far as authors' materials goes, what does that comprise?
Well, it sort of works in concentric circles. There's an article that I wrote for the CIFO website back in 2011 that talks about this if you're looking for the sort of NEPRI level. But the basics of it are we're looking first and foremost for actual drafts of creative work.
Uh-huh.
Multiple drafts from the very first crappy draft that says put something exciting in this scene and
right.
I don't care what color the curtains are and I thought they had a dog. From that first draft all the way through to the finished product, we're looking for all of the different iterations of the story or the novel or the poetry.
And this includes like cocktail napkins and things like that?
Yes, exactly. We
okay.
have... There aren't a ton of really wacky things, but we do have a barf bag from an airplane that had some notes jotted on it, unused.
Okay.
I'm very clear to specify. And Jay Lake, before he passed, threatened to give us a portion of his colon because he had colon cancer and he had it preserved in formaldehyde. I'm actually not positive whether it's in the collection or not because we're still processing the collection.
Okay. All right.
But we also have things like he was known for wearing Hawaiian shirts, and so we have one of his Hawaiian shirts.
Oh, no, okay.
Things like that. So we start with the actual work. We expand out to the business of the work, so correspondence and sometimes like random paperwork from agents and editors and things like that, piles of rejection letters, all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And then we expand out to the personal life to a certain extent. But since I'm working mostly with authors who are alive, they have an opportunity to erase their porn first before they give things to us.
Right, yes, okay. I'm interested to know what the advent of interactive and digital technology has been on what you do. I mean, you wrote a book with it with Beth Whitaker called Special Collections 2.0. And how has that sort of changed the way that things get archived?
Completely. In the sense that starting in about 2006, when I say to someone, I'd like to, you know, my university be the home for your archives, they're as likely to hand me a flash drive as they are to hand me paper.
Sure.
And I was a classically trained rare book person. I know what to do with very old books. I was not trained initially to deal with what do I do to preserve the bits that are on this flash drive.
Right.
There's a learning curve there that we have been, that I have been working through. And my colleagues and I are just finishing up our second national grant that allowed us to have research time to figure some of this out, particularly as an under-resourced institution. So basically what goes into keeping track of paper is that you document what you have, like you make lists of what's there, you organize it roughly, you put it in boxes in a controlled environment, and you ignore it unless someone wants to use it.
Okay.
And that will hold on to the paper for 500 years, as long as you don't dunk it in water, set it on fire, or generally muck with it in particular ways, paper will last a really long time.
Sure.
The problem with digital stuff is that you have to get it off of the flash drives.
Right.
And you have to get it onto a networked server. And then you have to have a system that will allow you to add descriptive and preservation metadata to it so that you can identify things like the file type.
Yep,
and
yep.
Let me know if I'm getting too neepery here.
No, that's exactly that was my question.
Because I teach day-long workshops on how to do this. So, you know,
sure.
I have like 8 hours worth of this material.
We've got plenty of time.
So you were warned.
Is there a process for digitizing physical items that you have? Are there things that you're worried about possibly losing or that aren't in great condition?
Generally speaking, no. Our dime novel collection, however, is a specific example of things that we are scanning and digitizing because they're so fragile that it's easier to provide access electronically because it's less wear and tear for people who just want to read the story.
Yeah.
If they don't need to actually physically handle the object for any particular reason, we can just give them a PDF of the story and everybody's happy.
Yeah.
And you know, you scan it once, PDF remains available as many times as it needs to be downloaded. So that's something we've been slowly working on, and we are in the process of dealing with a grant that will hopefully move that process forward. But depending upon when this episode drops, I can't confirm or deny whether we have the grant.
Okay. So, all right. Well, fingers crossed then.
Yeah. So we're hopeful that then starting in January, there will be a more robust attempt to provide even more access to even more dime novels. How's that?
That sounds amazing.
So yeah, we are working towards scanning some of the dime novels, but those are very specifically not in copyright. They're in the public domain. We don't generally, we will scan things for patrons in the sense of, hey, can I get a copy of the thing for research purposes?
Yeah.
But we're very careful about copyright, and all of our agreements with our authors include being very careful about copyright. If someone wants to access, say, the electronic files of Mary Robinette Kowal, who has given us some.
Sure.
What a patron would have to do is they would have to locate which files they wanted to see, and they would have to come on site, and we have a locked down portable hard drive
with
copies that they can look at, but they can't print from, and they can't make copies. So they can read it, but we would have to go back to Mary to get permission to provide copies.
Sure.
Simply because those items are still in copyright, there may be other contracts in force that we don't have access to.
Yeah.
And, you know, we desperately do not want to be in any situation where, for instance, ebooks end up in, you know, on the internet being given away for free when people are trying to make a living. So we're very careful about that.
Okay.
All of our materials are contained in a couple, they're on a networked server, and then we have cloud storage that is locked down, that is only available to the people that administer it, that provides a couple of extra copies and make sure that the copies stay stable, so that those materials can sort of self-heal if bit rot happens or if the files get corrupted.
Yeah, right.
So that's kind of where we're at right now. Eventually, we'd love to be able to do things like emulation. We can do a little bit of migrating files to more preservation-friendly formats, but that's really about it.
Sure.
So it's sort of, It's a messy thing because we're still building our systems and we've been collecting before we built our systems.
Right.
So it is iterative. It is a work in progress, but we have made a lot of progress. And for instance, it only took 5 years, but now we have an actual library policy about what we commit to preserving and what we don't when it comes to digital materials. And that's something that we hadn't thought through that, you know, 5 years ago, and now we have. So
I get the feeling that the sort of industry itself is sort of on the, you're sort of on the edge of the things that somebody who did your job, even, you know, 10, 20 years ago, would have to deal with now.
Completely different. I mean, it has been a learning curve, and there are, you know, there are folks that are still playing catch up in the field. And that's part of what the second grant I was on was doing, was helping them to get caught up. I can categorically say that about between 50 and 70% of my job were things that did not exist when I went to library school.
Right, yeah.
Just didn't exist.
Right.
Weren't a thing. And and now they're 50 to 75% of my job, depending on the day.
Sure.
Wait, do you guys have microfiche in the library at all?
There are microfiche and microfilm in the microfiche and microfilm department. I supervise the person who's in charge of that, but other than that, it's not my problem.
Okay. That's fair.
Those collections are getting weeded because they're not being used. Most of our patrons, as you might imagine, much prefer the digital archive of everything having been scanned that they can search by keyword.
Yes.
Because I've never, ever, and I say this as someone who has done projects in grad school back when dinosaurs roamed the earth in the late 1990s, that involved reading a lot of microfilm. I have never met a person who's like, yay, microfilm!
Right, right.
Great, it's great for preservation, but for use, it is just completely pants. It's terrible.
Yeah, old-timey Google, basically, yeah.
Yeah, only not as efficient by a lot.
No, no. You talked about Doctor Who before. We were talking about Doctor Who before. You edited a collection of essays called Chicks Dig Time Lords.
Yes.
And I wanted to talk about your history with Doctor Who. How did you come to Doctor Who?
I married in.
Of course.
Yes. When Michael and I got together as a couple, you know, part of our courtship was him showing me Doctor Who episodes and hoping they stuck.
No, was this the old ones or the new ones?
This was the classic series. This was back during the Wilderness years when the new series had happened yet.
Sure, yeah.
So we got together in basically 1999.
So that was right around the time of the Fox movie. Did you see that?
Yes, I have very fond feelings for the Paul McGann TV movie.
I do as well.
I do too.
I actually recorded a live commentary on it for Verity.
Oh, really?
Because I love it so much.
Gotta look that up. Okay.
I think that, I mean, I know he's done a lot of audiobooks and everything, but I think he's just so charming. And I really wish he had gotten more screen time as Doctor Who, because he was just lovely. But
oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, his audio adventures are fantastic for what it's worth. Big Finish has a whole run of them, and they're really quite good. So, you know, shameless plug, not that I get anything out of it, but... But the Big Finish Eighth Doctor adventures are fantastic. They introduce new companions. There's one from the 1920s named Charlie Pollard, who's amazing. It's just fantastic stuff.
So there were two interviews in Chicks Dig Time Lords. Did you or Tara conduct those interviews?
Yes, we both did. We came up with the questions together, and Tara did the bulk of the interviewing. But you know, we sort of workshopped the questions a little bit, and then she ran the interviews.
When we were talking about Doctor Who at Convergence, I think that you had said that your favorite Doctor was Sylvester McCoy. Is that still true?
Yes. In terms of... okay.
It's a complicated
I have multiple
question.
Answers to this question. Because
we all do.
If you're asking me the Doctor that I have the biggest crush on, it's always David Tennant.
Oh, sure.
Like, I am a diehard 10th Doctor fan. But if there's... a Doctor that's really my Doctor, it's my favorite TARDIS team, and that's the Seventh Doctor in Ace, Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I know that you had said that you were impressed with Capaldi so far.
Oh, yeah. He's amazing. I mean, he's had really good writing this season, and as an actor, he has just been astonishingly good. It's hard to find words. He's so damn good.
How do you feel about the future of the series going forward, especially with Chris Chibnall taking over as the showrunner?
Well, I often joke that I'm looking forward to the vilification of Chris Chibnall merely so Stephen Moffat will get a break because he'll now be deified because he's no longer in charge.
That's dark, but I can understand it.
No, but this is yeah. the way of fandom, and this has been the way of fandom since Barry Letts was producing the series in the 1970s. Whoever is in charge is typically vilified by fandom for not making the version of Doctor Who that lives in fandom's head. Right. Whatever that is. So this is Spanish tradition, really, going yes. back to the 70s. I think it's going to be fine. I mean, I think that Doctor Who as a series is incredibly flexible. I also think that I would not be surprised if in the next decade at some point Doctor Who takes a break for a bit. So people have a chance to miss it some more, and then it comes back again. Mm-hmm. That would not shock me at all. It will be amusing to those of us that are old school fans that lived through the wilderness years, 15 years with nothing.
Yeah, right.
You know, when we listen to fans now who are like, it's been a whole year since Doctor Who, and we're like, amateurs.
Right.
You know, it's going to be interesting if the series does take a break to see how fandom responds to that, because, you know, there's always the fear that it will never come back. But at this point, I think that it is an institution to a certain extent in British television in the same way that, like, I would be shocked that the James Bond films stopped sometime.
You know,
50 years of tradition is hard to undo.
Exactly.
But I mean, I think Chris Chibnall is a perfectly logical choice for the next showrunner. He has a successful TV series with Broadchurch that used a lot of the same actors that had been on Doctor Who,
right?
That had, you know, that came in on time and on budget and was wildly successful and popular. He has done a lot of writing for Doctor Who. He was the showrunner for Torchwood, and all of his Doctor Who episodes always meet the level of perfectly acceptable Doctor Who. Some of them are not like the best episode, but if you're looking for sort of this is a prototypical middle of the road episode of solid Doctor Who, Chris Chibnall's your guy.
Sure.
In his Torchwood work, he took a lot more chances. Sometimes that went really, really well. And sometimes you get Cyberwoman. However, it's going to be interesting to see what Chris Chibnall does in the next couple of years as he figures out what's going to happen next.
If you had to pick, would you have a vote for best episode?
I don't like to do best because I think best is as much as I can talk about favorites, but well, my favorites and the ones I think are the best are different.
Okay. I understand what you're saying. I really do.
My favorites all have costumes. Honestly.
Okay.
And I'm kind of hoping that this coming season is going to end up being my absolute, that my favorite will show up because I've seen some set photos that the BBC put out and they are finally making an episode set in a period that I've been begging for years.
What is that period?
It's the Regency period. There have been set photos of Peter Capaldi and Pearl Mack in Regency clothes.
Okay.
And I have been yelling on the podcast for literally years about how I cannot believe they haven't done a Jane Austen episode. Like, what is wrong with you?
Right.
Yeah.
How
no.
could you not do this? So, you know.
They've done Shakespeare.
Pandering directly to me.
In your essay in Chicks Dig Time Wars, you talk about how Doctor Who fandom is like a family on its own, and it's a very inclusive fandom. What is it about Doctor Who that help creates such a strong bond, and it's so inclusive and just really connects people?
I think that a lot of it is that the ethos of the series is about sort of going out and doing what you personally can to make the world just a tiny bit better. And that no one is unimportant. These are messages that come through in Doctor Who over and over and over again in different stories. And I think that sort of seeps into people's consciousnesses, whether they are there just for the sort of whiz-bang adventure or not. Mm. So, I mean, our experience of the Doctor Who community is one where everybody has been very, very inclusive and very welcoming. You know, there are always cul-de-sacs of different aspects of fandom that are not as welcoming, and that's a shame.
Sure.
But, you know, that's just unfortunately a function of human nature being what it is. Not everybody actually gets the message. But the Doctor is all about never cowardly, never cruel, you know.
Right.
There's the Craig Ferguson thing where it's what? Intellect and something, not brute force and cynicism. Intellect and romance, not brute force and cynicism. and that is a really good descriptor for Doctor Who because it's often about thinking your way out of problems.
Sure.
And it's often about finding a connection with people that you disagree with to try to find a way forward together to solve a much bigger problem.
Sure.
Now, sometimes it's about blowing up planets, and sometimes it's about towing planets to different places, and sometimes it's about, you know...
Cyber women.
But, but still, the ethos of the show is that it's going to be okay. Like, if... I mean, there's plenty of noir-type shows out there where everything is grim and gritty and dark. I mean, if you want that, Game of Thrones is available to you.
Right.
You know, no one is safe on Game of Thrones, ever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Doctor Who, there's plenty of... There's lots of body count, but fundamentally, you understand that that at the end of the day, the Doctor not making it right is the exception, not the rule.
Sure.
The rule is that it gets sorted out, and it provides a sort of closure. And... especially in a world where people don't always feel terribly secure, that is really reassuring.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that people watch murder mysteries because, you know, it's not because you like watching someone get killed in the first 5 minutes of a show. It's because you like watching a detective take something that looks like chaos and by the end of it, tie it up into a very tidy, understandable bow.
Right. And then they catch the guy, yeah.
And then catch the guy and justice is served.
Right,
right?
Yeah. A lot of the essays in the book deal with that idea of the positivity and sort of the inclusiveness. And I've seen that personally a lot in a lot of different fandoms. Did it surprise you as somebody who has kind of was relatively new a little while ago, but has been delving into fandom and communities for the last decade or so, the inclusiveness you found?
I don't think I was surprised per se. I think I was surprised at the warmth. Like, I think that there's a distinction between... between, yeah, you know, everybody's welcome and we're really glad to see you.
Yeah.
And I think that my experiences in fandom in the past decade have been much more on the we're really glad to see you side of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, we're so glad you're here. This is awesome. We're going to have so much fun. That the fact that people can express unchanging, unwavering enthusiasm and that's okay. And it's not about being cynical and it's not about being too cool to be excited about stuff. I think that's a large part of what makes fandom fandom. It's that be unabashed about your enthusiasms because life is kind of crappy sometimes and there's not enough joy in the world. So if this specific, like, okay, I'm a Jack of All Trades fan in addition to other series, which was a teeny tiny show that happened as a replacement for Hercules back in the Renpick days.
Right. And, this, like, was the Bruce Campbell one?
The Bruce Campbell one, yeah, with Angie Dachin in costumes. Right up my alley.
Right.
You know. And I loved the heck out of that show. And I just loved it. I didn't have to have... there was nothing about it I didn't love.
Right.
Even, you know, every fave is problematic in some way, and it's critique is a valid form of fandom, absolutely.
Sure.
But it comes out of that place of love. Mm-hmm. And I loved that so... holy. And, like, you know, nobody watched that show, but it made me happy. And that was enough. I mean, I'm watching it happen in Hamilton fandom now. Like, Hamilton fandom went boom, and it's just amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, after the election, Hamilton fandom has sort of been doing a lot of self-triage with people who are feeling unsafe and people who are feeling unwelcome and, you know, horrible things happening in different places. Hamilton fandom, this is where people are finding their community and where people are finding a way to connect and to feel okay again for a little while that allows them to sort of go on in daily life and just be without feeling like they're going to collapse all the time.
You have a new anthology that was published recently called New Directions for Special Collections. Can you talk about that and who it's for?
Sure. That's my second librarian book. So what it is it's called An Anthology of Practice. And what it is basically, in some ways, it's a response to a book called Rare Book Librarianship that was published about 3 years ago. This is what academics do, right?
Yeah, right.
And, you know, keep in mind, I'm faculty, so I'm required to publish in order to, like, get promoted and things like that. So this is basically one of my projects that is going to move me towards full professor at my job.
Mm-hmm.
But part of it was reacting to that book because the perspective in the Rare Book Librarianship book was not as inclusive of what life in special collections land looks like for those of us that are not at exceedingly wealthy institutions.
Okay.
Okay.
And there are a lot of us, and I get cranky about that. So Beth and I, our previous editor contacted us and was like, well, do you want to update Special Collections 2.0 because it's starting to stop selling because it's out of date now because 5 years in tech. And we were like, well, we want to do something a little different. And so we pitched this, which was a series of essays that are snapshots of special of life in Special Collections now. They bought it, and you know, and by bought it, I mean they commissioned it, but we haven't actually seen a dime because it's academic publishing. We won't see any money, if any, for a while. It doesn't work the same way as commercial publishing at all. It is something where if we get paid, it's gravy. But I get paid in getting to full professor and getting a raise out of that. That's how I really get paid.
Right.
For that book. So it's a bunch of essays written by people who are experts in the field, people in the front lines on the in the trenches, doing special collections work day to day, talking about their experiences. It's everything we talk about all different aspects of special collections. So that's everything from collection development and getting stuff to the people who do the cataloging and the metadata for keeping track of stuff to the people who preserve the stuff, because these are often different people, to people that work with social media to promote the stuff and to make it available to people, to people that are doing archiving of things like we have an article on documenting Ferguson. Which is a movement to document the Ferguson uprisings as oral history, and it's a community sourced attempt at documenting what happened in Ferguson. So it's sort of archiving on the fly, because that's what contemporary archiving looks like sometimes. And we talk about things like archival silences to a certain extent, and the kinds of things that get left out of narratives because the choices that we make as cultural heritage professionals, we literally are choosing what will survive long term, and we have to be aware of that and be aware of our unconscious biases when we do things like that, because it's very easy to default to what the, you know, generic cultural norms are and to ignore a whole lot of people. It's about making sure that we are consciously working towards being inclusive in our communities and in our collections when we build them and when we take care of them and in terms of how we take care of them.
That's a lot of responsibility for an archivist and a sort of ersatz historian.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the historians can't do a damn thing if we're not doing our jobs.
Exactly. let's talk about your podcasting efforts. You're on a couple different podcasts. The first of which I can think of is Verity, which is six smart women talking about Doctor Who.
That's right.
And do you ever find, so on your show, you must talk about all aspects of Doctor Who. Do you find that you often disagree with your co-hosts about things?
Are you kidding? Yeah. There's six women.
Well, we're talking about
all the time. Yeah. But you can go back to our last episode. We talked about where this year is we do a theme each year. So all of our theme this year for the episodes that aren't just reviewing whatever was just broadcast. So we do a theme around that. This year is a year of firsts. So we've been rewatching season one, William Hartnell.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
And we've also been watching series one, Christopher Eccleston, and then doing episodes on those.
Sure. Okay.
And we just finished watching The Censorites. And, you know, we rotate. There are always four verities to a podcast, basically, most of the time.
Oh, I see.
And we rotate, you know, that way we all sort of do, we all do some, but we don't all have to do all of them.
Right.
We did The Censorites, and there was no agreement. There were two of us that were like, this is the most boring thing ever. And there were two of us that were like, I really dig this. And we were just like, you're so wrong. No, you're wrong. You know, we disagree all the time, to the point where early on. So Verity, to a certain extent, came out of a lot of bar conversations that we were having at conventions anyway. We literally, to a certain extent, thought we were so entertaining. It was like, yeah, we should totally do a podcast of us arguing. Sure.
Yeah, okay.
So early on, Liz Miles, who, again, you know, who Scottish Liz, who is a dear friend and is also on the podcast, she and I were on an episode where we talked about School Reunion. Now, I love School Reunion, and Liz hates School Reunion. And we had a knockdown, drag out argument that we've had in the bar at conventions at least three times. but we had listeners who were not used to, and this was very early, it was like our first five or six episodes. We had listeners who wrote in and were like, are they okay? Are they still friends?
Sure. Oh my.
they were convinced that the podcast was breaking up before their very ears. And it was like, no, we can disagree about Doctor Who and still be friends. Like, this is a thing for modeling that adults do.
Right. Now, if you were arguing over Marco Polo, I could see that.
Why would we argue over Marco Polo? It's one of the best episodes ever made. And it will remain so until we actually get to watch it.
We actually tried watching. So, like, you know, the audio for the Marco Polo is still available.
Yes.
And then they have, like,
the telesnaps, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yes. We actually attempted to watch that. I think we got through maybe one or two hours.
Really. Yeah.
It's an acquired taste.
Yes.
And just the audio version does sort of take the sting out of the whitewashing a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
A little bit.
Only a tiny bit, though. Yeah. Do you also do a podcast for Uncanny Magazine? Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Can you tell us about that? Oh, congratulations on your Hugo win for
Thank
Uncanny,
you.
By the way.
Basically, Michael and I serve as the MCs of sorts. We do all of the sort of introductions and linking narration between a brand new story, a brand new piece of poetry, and an exclusive interview that happens in every podcast episode. So the podcast comes out monthly, and the first podcast will have a story from the current issue and a poem from the current issue and an interview with an author that's exclusive to the podcast. Sure. And then the next month, it'll be a different story and a different poem from the same issue and an exclusive interview just for the podcast. Sure. And then, you know, when the next issue drops 2 months later, we do the same thing. So it's tied to the episode. It's tied to the magazine, but they are distinct episodes, and it's structured like a magazine. It's designed that way. And we're really proud to not only have won a Hugo for that, but we also just found out that we won Parsec Awards for it, too.
Yes, of course.
That's awesome.
So we're really super proud of the podcast, we're super grateful to our producers, Erica and Steven, who make us sound great.
We've talked a lot about new media, and of course you're on a couple different podcasts. Why do you think it's such an effective communication tool?
Because we all spend a lot of time in our cars.
There you go. Okay, question answered.
I mean, basically, most people I know consume podcasts on their commutes in some way, whether they're walking or biking or in their cars or on the train or whatever. And I think that, you know, people learn and enjoy content in different ways. So for some people, podcasts and audiobooks are the way that they consume their media. And for some people, they prefer to read rather than listen. And some people do both. And that's totally cool.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why we launched the podcast simultaneous with the magazine. We wanted people to be able to consume content in the way that made sense for them.
We have a couple minutes left. Do you want to talk a little Outlander?
Sure.
I think we talked about Outlander a little bit at Convergence, and we are more television fans than we are book fans, but
okay.
We are still excited about it. And I don't know, it's supposed to come back sometime next year. I don't think they've really said when exactly.
Yeah, it should be coming soon.
Yeah, as somebody who's read, I know, at least the first two books, how do you feel that the TV series has tracked with the book so far?
I think it's done a pretty good job. I mean, I'm now through book three, because my pattern has been whenever they announce the next season is coming, then I read the next book.
Sure.
So I'm through book three because season three is coming. I think that they've done a really good job of generally sort of staying to the books, although I think tonally the series actually is a little more serious than the books, believe it or not.
Interesting. Okay.
But maybe that's just because my experience of reading the books is like, this is like crack fic. I mean, it's the books to me read much more as bad decision making theater over and over and over again,
where Claire
and Jamie talk themselves into doing colossally stupid things to try to save the world from themselves. And you're just like, how did you get from here to there? And yet the chain of logic somehow makes sense to them. I think the show kind of makes them less bad decision-y and more just earnest. And that's okay. You know, I mean, obviously with any TV series, there are characters that get cut. There are characters that get sort of merged together and things like that. But the sort of core group of characters for each season, they've done a really good job of casting and acting and everything. I mean, you know, I'm Team Murtaugh all the way.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
he's,
you know, it's
freaking awesome. He's
amazing.
I love Murtaugh. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's things like that. You know, I enjoy the books. And I enjoy the series, and they're sort of tied together in my head, but only sorta. Like, I still kind of view them as separate things. This is a series that I just kind of flail about. I don't have really good critical filters for it because I'm just like much kilt, very wow. Like I just.
I think that's okay though, you know,
because
you have strong, you know, it's something I think a lot of people who are fans of the show and the book have very strong feelings about it and just are really excited that it has another outlet, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. So. And I do think that Katrina Balfe got robbed for not getting an Emmy nomination for that storyline. Because, oh my God, that was heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. I know that I've read that they're up for like a lot of Directors Guild awards and stuff this year. So I think they'll get some stuff.
Yeah, I hope so. Because I mean, it's just really well executed. And of course, you know, I'm always a fan of being able to play Spot the British Actor. So that's always fun.
Right. Yeah, that's a good game for that. I want to mention your Geek Girls Chronicles books, of course, Chick-Stick Time Lords and Chick-Stick's Comics, Weedonistas as well. I also wanted to mention your story collection, Glitter and Mayhem, and also the books that we've talked about before. And those are all available, of course, on Amazon and other places, I'm assuming?
Yes, they are available anywhere fine books are sold in paper or electronically.
Ooh, fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us, Lynn Thomas. When can people, or where can people find you online?
You can find me at Lynn M. Thomas on Twitter, and you can find me as part of the Uncanny Magazine team. We are at Uncanny Magazine.
Great. And the last time we talked, you had mentioned a Patreon. Is that still going?
It is still going. It is patreon.com/Uncanny Magazine.
Uncanny Magazine. Okay. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Let's send people to her sites. We'll reiterate that you can find Lynn at her personal site, LynnemThomas, Lynn M. Thomas, all one word, .com. Also, if you want to check out Uncanny Magazine, I would strongly, strongly suggest that you do that at Uncanny Magazine, altogether one word, .com as well. And also, you can support them at their Patreon for Uncanny. There's actually a little link that says support Uncanny, and that'll take you to their Patreon there. So you can try that.
Gotcha.
Or go to Patreon and search for Uncanny Magazine. And you can follow her on Twitter at, you guessed it, LynnemThomas, all one word, .com. If you search for Lynn M. Thomas on Amazon.com, you'll find her books like Chicks Dig Time Lords, Weedonistas, Chicks Dig Comics. Whew.
Yes.
This. She's got going on.
Yes.
She's got a lot going on. She's an industry to herself. So go take part of that industry and join the conversation. And thanks again to Lynn for talking with us.
Yeah. Come on. Dance for me, baby. Yeah. Uh-oh. You feel like? All right. Come on. Don't stop now. You done did it. Come on. Yeah. All right. Hold up.
It's like Shakespeare, but with more punching. It's like Goethe, but with lots more crushing. It's like Titanic, but the boat's still floating. No, it's not. The mother effing boat is exploding. Next wave. It's next wave.
Yes, it is.
That is the theme song by the band Thunder Thighs. Let me finish. This is a comic book that has a theme song. Nick Lowe, the editor of the series, along with his brother Matt, wrote this song, and the band is called Thunder Thighs.
So did they record it?
Listeners will hear it on the way out of this segment.
Awesome. This comic is amazing in a lot of different ways. Like, just, I think you mentioned it before when we announced that we were going to do this, that this is like Warren Ellis having fun. I didn't know
what does that look like?
that was possible. And yet it is, because this is completely fun.
I think he is somebody who, Warren Ellis, of course, storied, we'll call him storied, his beard is storied.
Absolutely.
Storied writer of many different comic books, ones that are specifically, quote-unquote, weird, also forward-looking. We've talked about Transmetropolitan on the show, and forget that. We got heads to kick, we got broccoli men to set on fire, and all kinds of good stuff.
I wonder if Warren Ellis hates broccoli.
Absolutely. He absolutely does. I'm surprised that the Shockwave rider doesn't run on Red Bull. And cigarettes.
Right.
They're just throwing like just cartons of Kools into the Kool thing, the engine shoot fire thing. Not a guy who does ships. In like, you don't even need 50, 25 words or less, like what's going on in this book?
Basically, there's this group of super soldiers that has decided to defect because they found out that the company that they work for, or the organization they work for, is working for a corrupt company and testing weapons of mass destruction on the United States.
Do they kick things until they explode?
They do.
The end. So this is a book that requires no previous knowledge of anything.
No.
But rewards previous knowledge as well.
Yes.
Because it takes a lot of elements that are pre-extant in the Marvel Universe and rejiggers them, remixes them, and presents them in a fresh way so that you don't need any backstory. But if you have some, great.
Right. So you're going to get the illusions if you have the backstory.
Use your illusions. Mm. One or two. So in that capacity, or in my capacity as the, you know, senpai to your kohai, at least for this segment.
Sure.
Do you have any questions for me that the audience will learn through as well?
Oh, God. Is there a robot in the Marvel Universe that drinks beer? Because I just think of Bender from The Simpsons.
Yeah, I got a Bender vibe off of that, too.
I don't know. I feel like that he was,
like,
taking...
steal from the best.
Well, yeah. I feel like he was taking from, like, everything.
Yeah.
Like the ship that they have, for example, like it was bigger,
it's bigger
on the
inside
than
it is on the outside.
And there's one mention, but it's like, oh, TARDIS.
Here's something else I forgot to mention about Warren Ellis. There's things that he takes super seriously, and then there's checks that he cashes. Mm-hmm. And like trying to create a cyberpunk epic that is also like a future biography of Hunter S. Thompson in the year, like in the 23rd century, mm-hmm. that would be like Transmet. This is a paycheck.
Yeah.
But it's the most fun he ever, the funnest money he ever made, probably.
Right.
Funny money? That's really it?
No,
okay.
It's
inclusive then.
The captain is, I don't know, like he's supposed to be like, I mean, he's not really Captain America.
Well,
they have a reference to Captain America later.
Right. Well, we should talk about who our superheroes are.
Sure.
The Next Wave team, who the book is subtitled Agents of Hate. It was required to be subtitled by that after the third issue, or after the second issue, because copyright, I don't know, Next Wave is probably some wave pool technology or some wireless
like
internet
type
thing.
They didn't want it to get grand confusion with New Wave or something. Or
yeah.
I don't know.
You think Coke was coming back?
I don't know.
So, yeah. So it's Agents of Hate. That's HATE, the highest anti-terrorism effort. Although I think that somebody just really wanted their initials to spell hate.
Absolutely.
The entire thing is a parody of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yep.
Because, of course, hate is run by Dirk Anger.
Which is just hilarious.
Who is very furious all the time. Mm-hmm. Anyway. And so the five heroes of the Next Wave team are Monica Rambeau, boy, who is the former Captain Marvel, former Photon, former Pulsar, former Spectrum.
All different characters within the Marvel Universe.
Current Monica Rambeau. I guess she didn't have to mix up somebody. If Janice Vell came back to Earth, he says, all right, I'm going to try the superhero thing again. What name do you want to be? I want to be Monica Rambeau. And Monica Rambeau's like, she's got to change her name to Lady or something. But she is a former Avenger, a former leader of the Avengers.
She keeps reminding people, like Britta, who's like, I used to live in New York.
Yes.
That's what it's like.
Yes.
It's like, oh my God, we know.
Oh crap. Oh crap. It's comic community. You just figured it out.
Yes.
It's comic unity. Elsa Bloodstone, who is of the Bloodstone family. Ulysses Bloodstone was like a kind of anti-hero. Well, it depends. Anyway.
He like hunted monsters.
But their family hunts monsters. They have this magic gemstone that makes them kind of invulnerable. You've got Boom Boom, who is Tabitha, can't remember her last name, who's a mutant.
Yes.
Was on X-Force New Mutants.
Yes.
You got the Captain, who is the only original character that
okay.
was created for this, who is nobody. He is just a pastiche. He has general flying brick powers within the meta narrative. He mentions the fact that he mentions his generic set of superhero powers.
Yes!
Also features enhanced vision. Yeah.
And then he has another line at some point that's like, oh, I wish I had something funny to say. And it's just
right,
like...
And then, of course, there is Aaron Stack, a.k.a. Machine Man, who is Machine Man.
Okay. So there is a character.
Jack Kirby, I believe, created him. Yeah.
Is he creepy in the original comics too?
No, but there's a creepy element to him because he comes from that sort of 60s sci-fi-ish. He actually comes out of Jack Kirby did a lot of weird stuff. Yeah. Then he also made some comics. And he made a comic adaptation of 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Okay.
And much like those like weird 70s Star Wars comics that had to start after the movie was over and the sixth issue was out, they're like, now what? And then they just whole cloth just started making stuff up. Chaykin and Roy Thomas or whatever, just there's green bunny men. There's all kinds of stuff. He kind of did that with 2001. He sort of expanded on it, and he created this character that was going to act as sort of a audience surrogate or whatever, named Machine Man.
All right.
But he wants to be called Aaron Stack. He's one of those like Pinocchio type characters. You know, he wants to be human, but he's a machine. And so he has a connection with the monolith, but that later on kind of turns to the Celestials, which are these sort of very Arthur C. Clarke-y kind of characters, these space gods in the Marvel Universe. And so that's all you need to know about that. That's pretty much all I know about that. It's complicated.
He reminds me of the android slash or maybe cyborg in Alien. What's his name?
Bishop?
Yeah, a little bit.
Aliens.
Aliens,
unless
yes.
you meant Ash from Bishop. Are we going Ian Holm or are we going Lance Henriksen here?
No.
Or Michael Fassbender?
Alien. I thought it was the first Alien.
Is he getting torn in half in a docking bay, or is he trying to choke somebody to death with a porno mag?
Second one.
Okay, let's talk about the comic books. So, and yeah, and they, like you said, they go on the run because they find out that hate is a front for the Beyond Corporation, which is a copyright, which is a corporation that is a front itself, or at least it used to be a terrorist group, Silent. S-I-L-E-N-T, which I don't think we ever find out what that means or stands for.
I kind of thought that maybe it was...
I'd love to hear this.
What is, like, Hydra or something like that?
Hydra doesn't...
Hydra's not an acronym,
but... No, it's just Hydra. Cut off one head and two will take its place.
What else is... Okay. What else is, like, acronym in the Marvel Universe that's a bad guy?
Next one. MODOK.
MODOK?
Yes.
Which there is a MODOK in this, too.
Is that spoilers? There's always spoilers in Comic Book Club.
Yeah.
Mental organism designed only for killing. I'm very tired. Yes, there is a MODOK in this, but don't get ahead of us. So they defect, and they take that ship with them, and they decide that they are going to use the sales plan from Beyond Corporation to find these sites that are all over, stashed all over the country, where this evil, nefarious corporation has been developing these weapons of mass destruction. Weapons that include explosive, ferocious koala bears.
Yep. That get thrown out of a plane.
Yeah. These broccoli soldiers called human resources. Who are trying to fire people.
That they literally grow.
Yeah. A machine virus in the form of like a kitty that crawls inside your chest and then makes you into a Voltron guy.
Yeah, a giant Voltron guy who just keeps eating metal and then beautiful small children.
And then, of course, in no particular order, Wolverine monkeys, flying laser shooting Stephen Hawking's.
That was amazing.
Cyber amazing. Pirates. Yeah. once again, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. I mean, we could go on forever about these. Even in 12 issues, I feel like there's a lot that goes on. And they very wisely designed it to be two-issue arcs. So there's essentially six story arcs that wrap up pretty quick. They go someplace, they go, oh boy, what's that? And they kick its head off, and then they move on to somewhere else.
They figure it out.
Yeah.
Like, they end up at one point, like, in this city, and... it's completely deserted. And they're like, why is this? This doesn't make sense. And then they like think, wait a minute. And then the Beyond Corporation is there. And there's like an upside down castle. And they're like, wah-ha-ha-ha, you know. And it's just like.
Because number none. The Beyond Corporation is there.
The CEO of Beyond. Gosh, I don't know. The fact that the captain got his powers from these aliens who seem like they're super intelligent and very articulate, and they come across him
right
when he is incredibly inebriated.
But everything is like a pastiche or a send up of other origins, and so yeah. In this case, you can steal from it's. That's like a very Green Lanternian,
yes,
thing. In fact, that's how Kyle Rayner got his powers. He was like leaving a bar, and Ganthnet, the Last Guardian, was like, "Here's a ring," and he's like, great, now what?" But yeah, the captain has a different response. What's the captain's name?
I don't know if I know it. Does he have one besides the captain?
We know it's dirty enough that Captain America beat him up and left him in a dumpster with a bar of soap in his mouth.
Well, yeah, I know. You get the idea they don't like the actual Avengers that much.
You get the idea the Avengers don't like them.
Yeah, that too.
Because they certainly don't call on them to help them save the country from the Beyond Corporation.
No.
Yeah, and there's these great cutaways in the style of your 30 Rock or your Family Guy or whatever, where a character will mention something and then we'll kind of go back really fast. And I think that comics can do that probably the most efficiently out of any sort of medium. You know, like when somebody's like, "Oh, Monica, you know, we always, you know, such a tight ass," and then flashes back to her childhood and this dog's barking and he won't shut up, and then she's like, she zaps it with her laser.
I know.
Or when they're fighting the teddy bears, and Captain's like, "Oh, I don't like teddy bears." They go back and he's coming into his room as a kid. And you see the silhouette of a bear hanging from a noose. And he's like, "Special bear?" And his mom's sitting on the bed with a drink in her hand. She's pointing a flashlight at the bear. "Special bear is dead." That's what we're dealing with.
I know. You just can't. You can't take anything seriously. And I love it. I mean, he just.
Oh, it's deadly serious.
I mean, the koala bears, like that, that was just like awesome. I love, too, there's like this great scene, like this almost like business meeting between the Beyond Corp and the Lord of the Dark Dimension, like because like Beyond Corp, which is like human resources broccoli men.
Well, I think it's the Dank Dimension, isn't it?
Is it the Dank Dimension?
Well, because I don't know if
I can't read my handwriting.
Well, the canonicity of the entire comic book is kind of in doubt,
mm-hmm.
because it's like, okay, fine, do whatever you want, take these third rate characters. Go nuts with them, but this is, you know, this is probably not canon. But that's been kind of played with because Monica has appeared in Mighty Avengers alongside Luke Cage and Jessica Jones, and they've talked to her. They've like mentioned her adventures in Next Wave. So we don't know. But the point is that they didn't want to use Dormammu, so they used sort of Dorflammu or whatever, and he's from the Dank Dimension.
Yes,
the Dim Dimension or something.
But what I liked about this was like that Beyond Corp, like they're introducing
the Dank Dimension. Sorry, continue.
They're introducing themselves and they want to exchange services, have a business deal, and like hands him his business card. You know,
right.
like we want, you know, the mindless ones, which are basically like clay things, and
yes.
What's her name? Bloodstone gets super excited that they explode.
One of my favorite parts is the very end where they fall into a trap set by the Beyond Corporation, and they go to this completely empty city.
Yes.
Which is itself a trap. Like it's, we trapped you in this floating city. You thought it was a normal city. And then they unleash like four different super teams on them. And it's clear that Warren Ellis has just got his thesaurus and then he's got a box of crayons and he's like, "Let's do this." And so there's the Vestry, and they're all like religious themed bad guys. And there's like the Doctor team, and then there's the team that's like the parody of the Avengers. So there's like the unbelievable Bulk. Or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah, right. And then there's a guy that just looks like Captain America, and it's like, well, I guess there's been like five or six Captain Americas that just look like Captain America, so it's fair there. And then, of course, the worst nemesis of all, Forbush Man.
He was just like bored and like doodling like some superheroes. Like, what are the most ridiculous superheroes that I could come up with? No,
Forbush Man has been around since 1955.
Wow.
Forbush Man was created by Stan Lee, and I'm actually going to get to do this, and it's going to make sense. But
jeez.
He created the idea of this character of Forbush Man to sort of, or actually it was Irving Forbush originally, this fictional employee that he could tell jokes about or like make fun of, you know? So it's like if you were, you know, if you were behind, he's yelling at Jack Kirby because he's behind on his deadline or something.
Sure.
Which I'm sure never happened. And he's like, come on, Jack. Irving Forbush, do I have to get him in here to do this for you? You know, that sort of thing. Or like, Steve, you can't handle a three martini lunch the way that Irving Forbush can.
Oh my gosh. Okay. All right.
Excelsior. A little more in his paycheck. That sort of thing. And so it turned into, once they started publishing, this Mad magazine started to get big, and Marvel had a competing magazine called Brand Ek.
Wow.
And it would be this jokey send up of the Marvel Universe. I mean, that's, look at Stan Lee. I mean, that's all built in. Like, he has a very self-effacing and self-aggrandizing at the same time, sense of humor and self.
Sure.
And so that he sort of became Forbush Man, and he was sort of like this character that was in the Brand Ek comic books. He was their What Me Worry, Alfred
oh,
B. Newman.
Oh, yes, like their mascot, yeah. If you will. Okay.
And so technically not, I mean, it's not like he's, I don't think he really exists in like the 616 universe, but
okay.
When Warren Ellis is like, guess what I'm doing? I'm doing a joke book for Marvel. Well, I got to have the main bad guy, or at least the main person that everybody's scared of, be Forbush Man. It's perfect. And it shows that, yes, you can enjoy Splode. Tabby just blowing people up. She spells her name with blown up people. And Aaron Stack's like, he spells your name wrong. She's like, no, I didn't. He's like, T-A-B-Y? Yeah. It's like, holy. But you've got that, and you've got all these like obscure references. The part where Mr. Nunn or whatever, he sends all their minds to, or actually Forbush does it. He sends their minds to different dimensions, and every single one of them is a send up of something else.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got Captain Marvel gets sent to like this, the Summer of Love, which is around the time that the Captain Marvel, the character in Marvel, came out. So I'm imagining it's like probably this like maybe Roy Thomas or just like Jim Starlin-esque sort of written, and the art matches it.
Yes.
Elsa Bloodstone gets sent to hunt monsters.
Yep.
Like Hellboy, and she ends up in a Mike Mignola book.
Mm-hmm.
And these are all drawn by Eminem. Like, yeah. We haven't even talked about the art yet. Like, he is a very talented mimic when mm-hmm. it comes to artistry.
No, absolutely.
He did a lot of stuff for something that came later, Fear Itself. And he is known as, still known as, one of the top artists. And not just a guy who, you know, gets in on time, does a good job, his lines are clean. Like, this guy puts the work in. Like, his stuff is amazing. And then he takes time off to do this joke book with Warren Ellis.
I know.
And he develops an entirely new style, which is this exaggerated, ready for Saturday morning cartoon or like anime show kind of style.
I mean, they're like basically like kick-ass Scooby-Doo team. Like, yeah, they're just, yeah, I mean, sure, that's pretty much what they do. They go and they find the problem and they take care of it. And they're not afraid to face it, you know, no matter what.
Well, I don't think that they even are taking it seriously enough to be scared.
No.
But something Eminem does really well is he really, in this cartoony style, nails facial expression.
Yeah.
That's the other half of any joke that's being told. Like, Ellis can put something in the balloon that's kind of funny or snarky or something like that, but it's totally either supported or undercut by what he's putting on the characters' faces. And you don't always get that in comics. In fact, you often don't get that.
Well, there's this really cool moment kind of early on where Machine Man has like this feature where he, one of his, like, you know, he is a robot.
Yeah.
He
does the bender eye thing.
Yes, where it can like zoom out to kind of like see closer or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I can't remember if it was, is it Boom Boom or Bloodstone who likes like, huh, let me see. And they literally like rip his eye out of his socket to see through
then, like a telescope.
The telescope, and he's like screaming in pain.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. And how does that fit into the continuity or the world of or the suite of his abilities? It doesn't. Who cares? Nobody cares.
It doesn't, but it's a really cool sight gag, and it's cool because I feel like comic books should have more stuff like that. We should have more things that the art can like show and help tell the story that like the words can't. You know?
Right.
And I think that's one thing that makes comics so great is because it has two different ways to tell a story.
There are a lot of action movie elements in this comic, but you could not tell this story in any other way. And they use the medium. They don't push it super far. They do have the meta referential sections that we talked about when all the characters are going to their own versions of whatever comics they go to. But other than that, they don't push the boundaries, I think, of the storytelling too far. And yet they make a story that can only be told in comics.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways they do that is in issue 11, which is officially their Civil War tie-in book. The cover says Mark Miller licks goats, like it says it.
Yep.
the head writer of Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And then to give you some value anyway, to give you the Civil War you're looking for, they give us this 12-page spread.
Yes.
Which is basically 6 2-page splash pages that is just the team linearly kicking ass against Wolverine gorillas and ultra samurais.
Yes.
And just all dinosaurs.
Flying Stephen Hawking's with lasers.
Yes, yes. And everything you can think of. And then throughout this series, they branding is super important. This is a superhero comic book, and it's also a team that was invented by a corporation. So it's always like next wave is love, or like next wave, we're touching your stuff, we're in your room right now. And so it's just these splash pages with things like that, and one of them is like you have to go out and buy this comic book 6 times right now,
making fun of variant covers.
Yes, but also if you do that and you open each one to the right page, you can have the 12 pages because it all fits together as one long art piece.
Oh.
Yes.
Smart.
It's a ploy. Yeah, right.
But they tell you it's a ploy.
Well, it's transparent.
Which just is so entertaining.
It's totally transparent. And they all this time they're fighting through State 51, which is like this helicarrier thing taken to the next level. It's an entire floating city.
Yeah.
That the Beyond Corporation owns, and they find out that first of all, they attack, they fight Number None, and find out that he is a robot being controlled by a baby MODOK.
A baby MODOK.
And the only reason that they have a baby MODOK is to gross you out, is to squick you about thinking about MODOKs making a baby.
Yep.
I don't even know how that works. I'm sure their chairs are involved. And they follow that baby MODOK to the head bad guy. It's Devil Dinosaur.
I freaking freaked out. I squeed. I want to know about Devil Dinosaur, but first I want to say I freaking love this character. Just because he is a T-Rex in a smoking jacket with a glass of champagne.
Yes.
And just the tiny little arms and everything.
Yes.
So is Devil Dinosaur an actual character within the Marvel Universe? Did he exist before this comic?
We bring Jack Kirby right back on in?
Yes.
I got to listen to some interviews with Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
I need a Jack Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
I got a Stan Lee, I don't got a Jack Kirby. I got a Steve Englehart, you don't want to hear it. Yeah, of course, yeah. Devil Dinosaur and Moon Boy. They were kind of a package team. So Moon Boy was like a prehistoric ape. This is like back in old-timey prehistoric days. And then he rode around on Devil Dinosaur. And generally not like a bad guy, just a dinosaur character. But he's, super intelligent, and he's mad that he's seen humans take over the Earth. And so it's not insinuated. It's plainly stated that at some point he just got fed up and ate Moon Boy. And then he decided he was just going to fight primates for the rest of his life.
Because he decided that Moon Boy was laughing at him and being like, oh, I'm going to ride around on you, and you're lesser than me,
right,
basically.
Right. You're the sidekick. I am the dinosaur. I am the smart dinosaur, yeah.
I eat you.
Right. And of course, next wave at this point has proven that they can take care of anything. In fact, his false bravado is one thing that lets me down. I guess if I'd have to complain about the book at all, some of the jokes are just clearly borrowed from other stuff, which is fine. It's fine to reference other stuff.
Yeah.
But if you're just trying to I got a deadline, or I wasn't paying attention and I wrote somebody else's joke into here, it's if you're going to do a thing, don't be a South Park and not a Family Guy? Is that a thing?
I think I know.
Because South Park's look at what we're doing. See what we're doing? But Family Guy's we'll just use a Simpsons joke and then.
Hope nobody knows.
You're not going to know.
Yeah.
You're not going to know.
Yeah,
and I don't even know if they know. Maybe they just watch a lot of Simpsons, and they're like, well, this is a joke for this part, but they don't think about where it comes from. I think that it's lazy. I think that it's lazy sometimes.
Sure.
I think that it's very fun, but it can be as lazy as the lyrics to its theme song, which, let's face it, are pretty lazy.
Yeah. Well, okay. Here's a question for
exploded?
You, Cal.
No, it's not.
Oh my
gosh. I just kicked it. Now it is. Next wave. No. Yeah, what's your question?
When is some work of art an homage or a homage, and when is it like?
Wow, how did we get
copying?
From Next Wave to that?
I don't know.
I think it has to. That's a good question. Like the Untouchables, Baby Carriage, Go Down the Steps.
Right.
People are like, wow, that's amazing. Yeah, did you know that's Battleship Potemkin? Because I feel like it's clear that.
That's what they were doing.
That De Palma was doing that.
Yeah.
Now we know because at Cannes or whatever, you can ask De Palma and he'll go, yeah, yeah, love all the Russian cinema stuff.
Right.
If does it have to stand alone in the work? Like, that's a good question.
Yeah. And when is it homage and when is it like
theft?
Yes.
Like Love and Theft?
Well,
like
what?
Bob Dylan's album, Love and Theft, that he stole.
Did he steal that?
Well, so Bob Dylan. All right, we really got to wrap this up because this is not Next Wave. Bob Dylan is such a provocateur and he's such a, for lack of a better term, card that a lot of people wondered why he would do a Victoria's Secret commercial like he did almost 10 years ago now. And somebody dug up in an old interview of him. I don't know if you can probably see it on YouTube. I used to be a Bob Dylan freak. I still kind of am, but I used to watch these old interviews.
Sure.
Where they would just, he, you could tell why he kind of went nuts and like crashed his motorcycle on purpose. So he could get away from all these people who saw him as the face of this movement. He's just this dude that liked to wear a harmonica and play guitar. And they'd set him up in front of all these guys in their, you know, their thin ties and their, yeah, and their tortoiseshell glasses. And excuse me, so are you saying that the youth movement is the... And he's like, he'd give them nonsense answers because he was just so sick of answering questions. So somebody asked him if he'd ever use his songs to sell products, you know, if he'd ever license them for that. And he's like,
right,
I don't know, maybe I'll... sell ladies' underwear.
Oh my God.
And so some people think like, yeah, he waited 40 years and then he made good on it. And he probably made a whole lot of money.
Well, I think he was probably talking out of his ass at the time, but then he was like, why the hell not?
Okay, he might have also looked at that interview himself and went, oh yeah, I'm supposed to do that. And so, yeah, he borrowed maybe. So there are some lines in some of his songs on his album, Love and Theft, that come from, I believe it's a Japanese poet's poems, or like a book of his poems.
Okay.
But it didn't really affect him much. And the album is called Love and Theft.
Oh,
so he's still doing a thing.
Oh my gosh.
He is still doing a thing.
That's a little mind-blowing. Actually.
I know. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So is the time that he punched out Joan Baez while he was drunk when Knocked Out Loaded came out. I felt like that was going too far. You got to know, that's a deeper Dylan cut. So yeah, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just, I was reminded of John Carpenter, somebody who is very talented.
People referencing him or him referencing?
Well, people referencing him or blatantly stealing from him.
Oh, sure. Because I'm sure that he must, you can't be him. Mm, boy. Okay, now I don't know John Carpenter, I guess. I don't think you can be him without having loved movies and being influenced by stuff.
Yes.
But his stuff is so weird and original half
it's
the time.
It's so distinct.
I couldn't even think of who he would be referencing.
No.
My counter to that would be something like George Lucas, where it's clear he's doing, I don't know, 12 o'clock high when he's doing dogfights, or The Hidden Fortress is the entirety of Star Wars.
Right.
Force Awakens is, no wait, wrong guy. I mean, you can get it's that sort of thing where, sure, and we talked about this with Lynn before, you know, there's copyright laws, there's digital rights management and all that stuff, but I think the rule is like, if you can get away with it and everybody thinks it's cool, then we're good.
Right.
And if you go,
and if you're a cool guy,
what's the problem? I don't see a problem. Would you recommend this book?
I would recommend this book because you know what? It is fun. It is pure fun.
Yes.
And I think you will enjoy this whether you're a comic book fan or if you've never read a comic in your life. I think you will enjoy this. I think you will enjoy this more if you've read some comics, but just
no,
like,
previous history required.
That's right. It's just a really fun book. It's great to see Warren Ellis enjoying himself and Eminem as well. I think the two of them just riff off of each other.
I would recommend this as well. I did not enjoy this as much this time as I have in previous times.
Oh,
and I have
okay.
a feeling if I read it again, I'm probably gonna like it less, and perhaps going on
really
down the scale, but then maybe like a repetitive joke, it'll come back after a while and starts to become funny again.
Okay. Do you, why, can I ask you, why did, do you think you this, enjoyed it less?
You know, I enjoyed the bombastic-ness of it before. This time around, I just really got the sense of Ellis writing to a point and then being like, that's fine.
Do you
like,
think
why
this
isn't
is
this
something...
line tighter?
Right.
Why does that joke kind of fall flat? Why is there no joke here?
Mm-hmm.
Why do they run off and, okay, you're two pages away from the end of the comic, so this thing that was going to be this huge threat, you know, the captain tees it up and then Monica just melts his head and then, well, that's it. It's like, well, okay, well, that's, I know it's, there's no real stakes here, but that's real, that there are no stakes at all. This is a vegan steakhouse. No stakes. I don't know. But yeah, I would recommend it.
Okay. Awesome.
Oh boy. I don't know if anything can top that.
I think we could try.
Teen Witch could top that. Top that. Stop laughing. So I say that we move onward and upward from here. And the next thing on the schedule, in a move that's going to seem spontaneous, but was totally planned. Those Star Wars comics that we mentioned previously are what we're going to read. As you know, as you should know, next Friday is the release of Rogue One.
Yes.
A Star Wars story. It just makes it sound like it's a Hallmark Channel movie.
I know.
But it doesn't matter. And it's exciting. It is uncharted waters. This is the first, this is what I'm excited about, is the first non-Star Wars Star Wars movie.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not going to focus on Jedi.
Well, I mean, it's Star Wars, but it's outside of the saga as we know it. And that's never happened before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm optimistic, but I'm also ready for a train wreck, too.
Yeah.
I just kind of want to see it. The circus is in town, and I want to see what they got.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to watch that. It is, you can think of it off the beaten path. And we thought, what better way to celebrate that in comic books by reading Star Wars comics that have nothing to do with the saga as we know it. In fact, we're talking specifically about those old Star Wars comics from the 70s. These things came out while the movies were in theaters. And that's what we're going to do. We're doing Star Wars, the original Marvel Star Wars issues 7 through 12. Why 7 through 12? Because issues 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 are the three acts of the movie Star Wars.
So episodes
so
4 through 6.
We mentioned Midtown Manhattan before at 616 50th Avenue or wherever they were back then. They got a manila envelope, rip it open, inside the Star Wars. And that's what Roy Thomas used, along with Howard Chaykin, Howie, I like to call him, to create these comic books, which are adaptations, but fairly faithful adaptations of the movie. Issue 7 hits. Now what? Here we go. And they just start riffing. They just start going.
I'm looking forward to this. This is Star Wars without a roadmap or star map.
Okay, now that sounds like a self-help book. Forget all that. We're going back in time to Star Wars issues 7 through 12 from the original Star Wars comic book series. Good luck, reader. You might not be able to join us on this one. Where we're going, you might not be able to follow. There are omnibuses, I know for a fact, that you might find at your local comic book store. You can try on Amazon. As far as digital goes, I don't know. It's a crapshoot. But join us if you can. Star Wars comics, next time on Comic Book Club.
It's like Shakespeare, but with lots more punches. It's like Goethe, but with lots more crunches. Like Titanic, but the boat.
So that was it. What a great show. Great interview, a great guest, and a great comic book. Surprisingly good?
Yes, surprisingly good, surprisingly fun, I think.
You've said fun like 57 times, so I think that you thought this thing was fun.
Yes.
Well, there is no more forever. Ha ha. I wanted to point out that this is our 190th and 8th, that's a new way to say it, show.
198.
Like that crappy X-Men storyline. And not unlike the crappy X-Men storyline, we're going forward. There's going to be a 199, and next Friday will be our 200th show. Now, coincidentally, it'll also be a Star Wars heavy show. Now, we love Star Wars.
Yes, absolutely.
Totally love it. That's why I have a Star Trek podcast. And
wait a minute.
We didn't really plan on our 200th show being a Star Trek extravaganza.
Star Wars.
Well, I did plan on that, but I had to take all the streamers and balloons back. So we'll be having a review of Rogue One, a review of the Star Wars comics, as we talked about before, but we'll also be talking a little bit about our 200th show. It'll be similar in format to our centennial show a year ago, probably on that day. A look back at the year that was, some favorite moments from past shows, and also we've reached out, again, we've reached out to a few luminaries and personages in the nerd and fan community, and some people have had some very nice things to say, so we'll be playing those things as well on the show. So I would invite you listeners to come back for our 200th episode. It's also a new direction for us as the show goes. We'll be talking about that on that episode. So if you've been thinking about bringing somebody on, telling somebody about the show, great time to do it. Great time to do it. Plus, if they like Star Wars, well, screw it. We're going to have a whole review of that.
That's right.
Of that Star Wars, a Star Wars story.
Why does it sound so incredibly cheesy?
It sounds, here's what it sounds. It sounds precious. And that's a problem. Oh. You want to watch out for preciousness.
Yeah.
In your gritty future space rebellion.
That's a my war opinion, movie.
My opinion.
How much
but I bet
twee.
Daisy Ridley's going to do a great job. So
stop.
What I want you to do is do a great job by following us on social media. Go to Facebook and Twitter and other places. Search for Just Enough Trope. It's not an Easter egg hunt. We're there. Mm-hmm. And when we're there, you see us, then subscribe, like, switch on, tune in, turn on, drop out, all the good stuff that you can do. Also, go to iTunes and check us out there. Search for Just Enough Trope. You'll find our iTunes page, our show page. While you're there, subscribe to the show. It's the best way to get the show. It comes right to you when it's ready, off the factory line from episode 1 to 200. You get it right there in your little eye pocket. That works. And sure. Leave us a review while you're there. We love hearing from the fans and love hearing what you'd like to hear on the show. We're always open to ideas, although we have a full dance card. We love sliding things in. So let us know what you want to hear, or I didn't say see. And also, while you're there, give us a rating, would you? The deal with ratings is when we get a high rating, when any show gets a high rating, iTunes knows that that show is doing a good job, and that show then gets moved up, bumped up in the ranks by iTunes, which means that it gets exposed to more people, which means that show can reach more people. And so if you want us to reach more people, we need a high rating from you. So please, while you're on iTunes, please give us 5 Devil Dinosaurs with or without martini and smoking jacket.
I like it.
Accessories sold separately. Next show is Monday. It is our Craft to Services segment, and we'll be back with Pow Wow. Reindeer Games starring Ben Affleck. And Charlize Theron and Gary Sinise with legs this time. Accessories are included. So check out that crazy John Frankenheimer movie. Don't get too excited. It's not one of the good ones. We'll see you then. Otherwise, we're going to sign off for today. We'll see you in the future. I am your host, Caliban.
I'm your co-host, Mikan Hanna.
Keep the geek fires burning. I sound like Casey Kasem, mad about the dead dog story.
All right, you literally
get this dead dog story out of here. Get the fucking we come in for the song. There's a fucking dead dog. I can do a better Casey Kasem.
Okay.
Keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars. Keep your stars on your feet and keep your head on the hands on the clouds in the butt.
What is happening now? Now you're just making nonsense.